Hello there, and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, and we are on episode 61. Yeah, that's right. We're over 61 hours into this. My name's David Brook. I'm here with Forrest Hollingsworth. Forrest, how are you doing this week?
Hello, my name is Forrest with two R's. I'm excited to talk about comics. I'm excited to talk about comics news. I'm excited to talk about comics reviews. I'm excited to talk about comics covers, comics marketing,
yeah.
Comics sales,
yeah.
Artists, writers, creators, a new book called No One's Rose coming from Vault Comics.
Hell yeah.
March 25th. Written by our friends Zach Thompson and Emily Horn. And they're going to be later on the show. I'm excited to talk to them as well.
You know, you're giving me this vibe like we're on the street. We should do this podcast on the street, like Jimmy on the street. I wonder, like, if we tried to, like, talk about the news, right? And, like, say, for instance, tonight, our first bit of news is just some more details coming out about Dan Didio's departure from DC Comics.
Dan Didio. More news. Right before C2E2. DC Comics. Ejected.
What if we walk up to a stranger and we said that, like, we have more details on Dan Didio, co-publisher of DC, leaving DC Comics. What do you think, man? It's like a 90-year-old woman.
What do you
woman.
Think about the comics news? You gotta make it very topical.
She's like, huh? Dan? Dan who?
Dido? What happened to Dido?
If we do it on St. Patrick's Day, someone might start singing Oh Danny Boy.
Oh, maybe.
Oh Danny Boy.
Oh boy, nope, cut that.
Nope, we're not cutting it. All my slinging stays. So yeah, in the top of the news, because we start every show with the news, some more details have come out about Dan Didio's departure. There are a couple websites that have got information that may or may not be true.
Yeah, there's information that I'm uncomfortable with the veracity of.
Sure.
Obviously don't want to talk about that. Fleeting Bool, if you want to check out their reporting.
Fleeting Bool.
Yeah.
Someone buy that URL right now. And then just like every time they post an article, just do the, like the reverse of it. What do we got for new news?
Dan Didio.
Yeah.
It sounds like his work ethic was not in keeping with the changes DC executives as well as Warner and AT&T were trying to make. He had a reputation as being somewhat hostile to new creators, very protective of other creators, micromanaging certain projects.
Mm-hmm.
The thing to me, and that's all, like, I don't want to make evaluations about the man's character.
No, we don't know him.
Right, we don't know him. And I think he has, as we discussed last week, played the heel when he needed to, took a lot of heat in person, in publication, on social media.
Mm-hmm.
He did so happily. I really think he was very happy to be working on the things he was working on. But it sounds like he was developing unhealthy editing and work practices that weren't going to fly, especially in the face of the launch of a new event. One of the biggest things that I saw was that he was kind of trying to, like, the secret 5G into existence.
If you don't know, the secret is where you just believe it and it comes true.
And then it comes true, right? And he was promoting it by taking pictures of charts and
right.
planning and stuff that right. was in his office, but that no actual content existed for.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a horrible way. If the company doesn't end up putting any of those books out or signing artists or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you're in a position where you have to save face.
That's like going, you buy a house, you don't know if there's a staircase or not to leave the house.
Right.
You take your back to the door and you go, there's a staircase. There's definitely a
right.
staircase.
Absolutely. You take a step it's back, exactly like that.
And your friends may or may not have built a staircase for you.
Right.
Let's hope they
yeah.
did.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. So I think that that was really probably the sticking point.
Right.
Like, it sounded like executives were unhappy or uncomfortable with the idea of Didio leading a new relaunch
mm-hmm.
when he was being, for lack of a better word, flippant about it.
Right. And I mean, this is a huge moment for DC Comics, in part because their sales have been dipping. They need yep. a resurgence of their line, and 5G was supposed to be this promising thing. And if he was just wishing it into existence, that's a huge issue.
Absolutely. I think it's very obvious or very telling that they really had no faith in it. They canceled their C2E2 Meet the Publishers panel right alongside Didio's exit. So they have no... Are there official DC panels at all at C2E2 this year?
Yeah, like DC Nation.
Okay.
Superheroes, yeah.
They removed the one that has been Didio's platform for a while, obviously. They don't want people talking or getting statements directly from, I'm going to assume, people like Jim Lee, either.
Yeah.
And I also think it just gives them the opportunity to kind of pivot away from him or anyone else saying anything about 5G.
Right.
So while this seems very poorly planned,
mm-hmm.
leaving it Friday on an afternoon, there's a lot of rumors that he didn't know he was being asked to leave, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not, again, those are unsubstantiated. It does seem like they were willing to take the hit to remove the possibility of talking about 5G at C2E2.
Although I have to say, before he was fired, most of the panels were already released, and there was no, like, 5G panel. Like, yeah, there could have been, right?
And I think that kind of substantiates what we're talking about in terms of, like, it was really his thing.
Right. Yeah, it kind of worries me that it appears, now we're recording this after every panel has come out, but it worries me a little bit there has been no statement yet. It worries me that there was mm-hmm. nobody at C2E2 or from the hub at DC, you know, saying anything about what's going on. And that includes Jim Lee, who's co-publisher as well.
Right.
It worries me that if they have nothing to say yet, they're still trying to figure out and scramble to figure out what to say.
They're trying to spin it. Yeah.
And at that point you realize, wait, that means he was kind of fired without a plan.
Yep.
And that's very mm-hmm. troublesome in a especially in a corporate yeah. world where
I think that's true.
There are, you know, hundreds of people who get paid by this company, and now we're in mm-hmm. a volatile or, you know, unsure place. That's dangerous. Right.
Yeah, I mean, they're lacking a clear direction. They have been for some time. I think we've been talking around that for a while.
Yeah.
But they're very clearly lacking some sort of narrative thrust in their comics, and I think also for their brand.
Yeah. Speaking of narrative thrust, Bad Idea has tried to change their narrative thrust a little bit. Last weekend when we were recording this show, they were at the Comics Pro Industry Conference. And when they were there, they let the world know that they are going to expand their first wave of participating retailers from 20 to 50 stores. If you don't know, Bad Idea is a new publisher that is only releasing single issues in select comic shops. And supposedly these comic shops are only supposed to give out one comic per person.
Right.
And now they're expanding to 50 stores instead of 20, which is obviously more than double. I assume it's because of the interest, but maybe that's just something they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
How do you take this news? What do you think?
Mediocre idea. I was, you know, I really want to know what kinds of relationships they have with the comic stores, with the retailers, and maybe even with distribution like Diamond.
Right.
Like, I don't know if Diamond has some sort of like, well, if you ship only 1,500 issues, you get a lower price or a higher price. I don't know what that negotiating looks like.
Yeah.
Maybe their distribution channel is totally different.
Mm-hmm.
I think you were telling me recently that you went to an Eisner Award-winning comic store in your area.
Correct.
And the person working at the store had not heard about Bad Idea.
No.
So, and we talked about this last week or the week before, where it's like, if I were selling comics, I would try to be in every comic book store possible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, I might do signings at Midtown.
Yeah.
Things from Another World, etc. Like, big events at those places. Mm-hmm. But I would want my comics to be everywhere.
Sure.
Not even targeting Eisner Award-winning retail stores is a weird practice. And it begs the question, if you're not trying to sell comics, what are you selling?
Right, right. It's so funny, too, because a year ago, I think it was a year ago now, DC came out and said, we're going to do these giant size books in Walmarts. We're literally creating a new place to buy comics.
Yeah.
And Bad Idea is like, no. We're gonna just scale it even further back. It seems so counterintuitive. And while I understand you and I right now are talking about them, and we probably wouldn't be if they didn't pull these stunts.
If there wasn't something newsworthy about it, yeah.
Oh, we forgot to even mention, they put out a YouTube trailer of like what, like 15 different celebrities who have nothing to do with comics except for maybe the RoboCop actor.
They paid a dozen or so actors via Cameo to promote Bad Idea,
and I think they were all via cell phone video.
Well, that's Cameo's shtick.
Uh huh. Okay.
That you just, celebrities pick it up where they can.
It was funny because I slacked you and I had just got the press release. And I was like, what the hell? And then you were like smartly started Googling and you figured out how much money it would have cost them.
Yeah, I mean, I know that there's probably a different price for promotional stuff. Like if you're promoting a product.
Sure.
They probably charge a different price.
Right.
But some of the actors did not have high asking prices to begin with for public consumption. So.
Right, right, right.
I mean, we're talking about like James Vanderbeek, Gilbert Gottfried, Orlando Brown. Mm-hmm. Some other folks in there. It was a weird, it's the whole thing is weird. It gives me a weird, uneasy vibe, and it feels like a scam.
Yeah.
And I just, until I see comics in stores or I see someone like, man, Matt Kent really put his all into this, and I'm not trying to make a value judgment about Matt Kent being involved.
Yes.
But if it's just like, until I see someone has it in their hand and has something to say about it, positive or negative, it feels like snake oil to me.
Mm-hmm. You know, to play devil's advocate, because that's what I do on the show.
You don't gotta do that.
When I was at that comic store, while I was talking to the shop owner, I saw the TKO books, and I don't see those everywhere. And I actually was like, oh, and I started looking through them, and I actually bought three of the trade paperbacks. And so there was like a draw that, you know, I don't see these like just anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, I was also probably, I have to fully admit, I was more, maybe even more interested because I know the creators, like Jeff Lemire, you know?
Sure, sure. I just also, TKO's model or ethos, well, maybe poorly executed, is inherently different.
Mm-hmm.
In that they're making digital comics deliverable to cell phones. They've even put an entire issue on their Instagram story. So that I get. Like, they're trying to change the channel consumers are getting their comics
through. Giving you
through.
More options, not less.
Right. Yeah. And they're not just putting, you know, what is basically a facsimile of a hard copy on Comixology.
Right, right, right.
Coronavirus? I can't drink my beers? With the coronavirus?
So I'm a little worried about coronavirus.
Because it's tanked Corona sales by 38% in the United States?
Yeah, I had a lot of stock. And, you know, I try to tell people if you just get the light version of coronavirus, it doesn't hurt you as much.
Oh, right. But you can also get coronavirus extra.
If you don't use a lime, you're going to get it.
Yeah, right. and scurvy.
So, no, this is actually kind of a serious issue.
It is.
My girlfriend's convention, where they're spending like $1 million for the convention space. She works for this software company. They just canceled it yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a big engineering convention. It's not quite the same thing, but it's still like lots of people getting together in one place and sneezing and coughing on you.
Yeah.
If you've been to a con, that's what they are.
I think we're going to pivot to saying the same can be said for C2E2 and Emerald City Comic Con and maybe even SDCC as concerns grow or, you know, mitigation isn't working out as well as the CDC might hope. It's a very interesting problem to have.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Games Dev Conference, GDC, was canceled just today as of our recording.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, they were kind of being resilient after big names like Sony and Microsoft and Epic Games and stuff pulled out.
Right.
They were still trying to say, no, we're going to hold GDC. And then I think it just became unsustainable for them, which is unfortunate because, you know, these companies, these brands, they make 5 to 10 year deals with venues.
Right.
Like San Diego Comic-Con was actually part of like a county-wide bidding process.
Right, right.
So that's obviously a major concern for the event organization planning acquisition part side of things, who is an entirely separate, you know, the folks that run GDC and the folks that run like Reed Pop, Emerald City Comic-Con and C2E2 are entirely different bodies than even the fans, publishers, and individuals, artists, and creators that are going to attend events.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very big issue. It's a lot of nerds who at times have dubious sanitation habits.
Okay, yeah.
In big places, interacting with each other. It's thousands of people fresh off airplanes and with shipped goods and all sorts of other stuff. And I don't want to stoke fear about how spreadable coronavirus is. I mean, the mortality rate's like 0.02% or something.
Right.
Like, just wash your fucking hands.
Yeah, it's that simple, yeah.
But I do understand the concerns about it, especially from a logistics standpoint, because Reed Pop may be feeling, you know, are we liable mm-hmm. for this?
What's interesting is talking to my girlfriend about the cancellation of her convention, her company may try to argue it's an act of God, you know, one of those.
Oh, sure. Like it's insured. Yeah. Yeah.
So you might be able to get out of it legally, but
right,
it's like
right.
how the problem with that argument is it has to get so bad that the insurance company's like, yeah, you're right. And it's not that bad yet. So for instance, C2E2, obviously it's going on this weekend, so it's not canceled, but and it's happening at a time when it's not quite it's not an epidemic, of course. It's not spreading like wildfire yet in America if it does. But when we get to say Emerald City Comic Con in 2 weeks, you know, things can change, right? As we know with the coronavirus, it only takes 2 weeks for this to come, you know, to get symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
then there's more cons after that and more cons after that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's largely a public perception problem. Like, GDC was actually taking heat for not canceling when as big a publisher as Microsoft pulled out.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So it's kind of an unwinnable thing. It's definitely something we'll keep our eye on. I've seen a lot of artists and writers signing books wearing gloves.
Oh yeah.
At C2E2 today. That makes sense. I'm not going to ask. I'm going to Emerald City Comic Con and covering it for the podcast and for the site. I'm totally fine with not asking any creators or anyone to shake my hand.
Yeah.
Whatever. I mean, it's just in the public interest.
No,
but it's
totally
interesting. It's been a long time, if ever, that I've seen an issue like this affect the industry.
To be honest, the thing I'd worry about the most is just the travel to get to the con, not the con itself.
Yeah, sure. Yep.
So speaking of cons, C2E2 is going on this weekend, and some news has come out already. We're not around to cover everything, but we might cover some of the bigger things next week if we allow it.
Mm-hmm. I think there will be a lot of smaller news stories out next week, as well as other sites, other publications, as well as AAPTComics.com get to publish their interviews with creators and stuff too.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, probably the biggest con of the year so far. Would you agree? C2E2?
I think that's fair. Yep.
So one of the bigger things that a lot of fans I saw on our Twitter, AAPTComics.com's Twitter, are very excited about is the resurgence of Silk in July. Silk is coming back, written by Maureen Gu and art by Takeshi Murazawa, which is pretty cool.
Yes.
The cover art by Stonehouse is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
This is a character a lot of people, you know, she's obviously an Asian American character. A lot of people relate to her. It's great to see her back. She's been in Agents of Atlas for a while, but she's back in her own solo book. So that's pretty dope.
Yeah, I'm very excited about it. I think that they did the right move giving fans some time away from her, or some time away from the poor reception to her kind of artificial importance in Spider-Man lore, or perceived artificial intelligence. I actually don't mind Silk at all.
Yeah.
But, you know, the bride and all of the inheritor stuff, and I think it rubbed people the wrong way.
Or remember when she was, like, horny for Peter?
Yeah. I remember all of it.
That was so strange.
Yeah. I do like the character, and I actually really like the spider totems mythology and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's unpopular, but J. Michael Straczynski is my favorite Spider-Man writer anyway, so it works for me.
Yeah.
I think they give her the breathing room that they need to launch a solo title for her again, and that's a good editorial decision.
You know what? Another editorial decision that we may not agree with, another event was announced at C2E2.
Yeah.
The Ten of Swords.
Let's put event in quotes for this one.
It's a crossover, though.
It's internalized.
One could argue Dawn of X was technically a crossover.
Right, yeah.
It's 15 parts. It's the new X-Men crossover. Ten of Swords. I keep wanting to say X of Swords.
Yes, it is stylized X of Swords.
It is breaking my brain to say Ten of Swords.
Yeah, I mean, well, you've got House of X, Powers of Ten, Dawn of X, Ten of Swords. And if folks don't know, that's a very famous tarot card.
Yeah.
So when the Ten of Swords is drawn upright, keywords related to it are painful endings, deep wounds, betrayal, loss, and crisis. And when it is drawn reversed, recovery, regeneration, and resisting an inevitable end.
Ooh.
Which it's all thematically appropriate, narratively appropriate for where the Dawn of X books are at right now, where Krakoa is at. So I'm pretty excited for it. The key art that they released is just like a ton of mutants with swords.
Yeah, by Mark
and
Brooks.
Like, that's a cool image to see and digest.
Yep.
And then also it's a cool image to think about in the arc of the narrative.
Right, yeah, because I mean, not all of these characters carry swords usually.
Right.
Like Wolverine, yeah. Well, I guess Wolverine has carried a sword, but not traditionally like now.
Yeah.
Wait, he has six swords on his hands.
Well, that was, you chose that character to call out. I wasn't going to say anything.
Hold on, wait a minute.
Cyclops.
I actually wrote a little article about it. If you want to go to aptcomics.com and check it out. I pulled some interesting information. For instance, just this week in X-Men number 7, we see in the Crucible, Apocalypse using a sword in the Crucible battle. Yes, that he's
big,
taking
big
place.
Big issue.
Also, by the way, Melody, who he fights, in the comic it's spelled Melody, M-E-L-O-D-Y. And when I looked her up, it's M-E-L-O-D-I-E. And now I'm just like, I don't know what's canon anymore. No, but I went back to House of X and Powers of 10 just to look through really quickly to find some sword shots. And I could not believe it, dude. You need to go back and reread it. There is like a sword in every issue.
Yeah, that I wouldn't be surprised. That makes sense. That's cool.
It is cool.
I like that kind of subtle payoff. I saw some folks calling out some of the data pages from Excalibur as well.
Right.
Because they... Apocalypse's like journal is explicitly referencing like tarot and magic and stuff like that, so it's
and
interesting.
There's talk that Xavier's sword is the old Cerebro. Like built from that, the one that Magneto made when he crushed.
So these are fun times to kind of plug into X Twitter, which is a big nebulous toxic and non-toxic thing. I know we alluded to that when we were talking to Chris Hassan last week, but I don't have as much fun on Twitter maybe ever as I do when there's a panel like this. People really fun connections. People gush over the art. It's really fun to be a part of a very enthusiastic community. And it does inherently make me more excited for the event, non-event, whatever it is.
When I saw this event, supposedly we'll have 10 mutants that are like plucked out to do whatever to save the day. I thought to myself, they are
get
geniuses.
Really into fencing.
Think about this. Dawn of X, right? They were like, let's look up all the lineups. We got a new lineup coming. We got the 10 of Swords. I can't say it. We have the 10 of Swords team coming. So we have a new lineup where people can conjecture and go, oh, do you think Nightcrawler will get along with, you know, so-and-so?
Yeah.
Or whatever. It's pretty smart.
The other big news that came out of the X panel, which was at C2E2 this weekend, was Jonathan Hickman spoke a little bit about Hellions, which I know is a book people have been a little uncertain about. He said Zeb Wells, the writer, sent him a like list of characters, the lineup that he would want. Mm-hmm. And Hickman was like, I don't know. And then Zeb sent the pitch and Hickman was like, yes.
Right.
So I'm very interested in that.
I guess he also commented on the Moira X comic. He said there's a reason why we haven't seen it yet. So it's still in the cards.
Okay.
So that's pretty cool.
The tarot cards.
Ho! You know, their next event? Dude, hear me out. They need to call it 10 of X.
Oh, huh? Yeah. X over X.
Yes.
X over 10.
X over eggs, easy 10. I don't know. And as always, keep tuned in to X-Men Monday every Monday for more details. I'm sure Swords of X, 10 of Swords, is going to be coming up soon in the weekly Monday column. Curated by Chris Hassan. Also, this weekend, we're not going to get too much detail, but there was the Next Big Thing panel from Marvel, where a bunch of things were revealed, including Ultraman.
Yes. Very excited about this. I didn't think that they were actually going to put any weight behind publishing Ultraman. Marvel does publish manga or manga characters occasionally, sometimes outside of the States, like in Asia. But it seems like they're really going hard for this. And I also like that it's in comic format.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool.
It's got Ed McGuinness doing the art on the cover art that they show with Matthew Wilson on colors, which is cool because he's, you know, obviously a traditionally American comic artist.
Right. Yeah. So I'm very excited for that. My wife and I, 2 years ago, spent a summer watching every single Godzilla movie.
Ooh.
All 36 or so of them, and rating them on our personal preferences and rewatching them and stuff. I'm very invested in the kaiju stuff. I like it a lot.
I once did a marathon of the Harry Potter movies in one day. I was so bored by like movie four.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also out of the next big thing panel was interior art for Thor.
Yep.
Where we get to see him fight Galactus. We get to see him have a band around his eyes as if he's blinded.
Beheaded Galactus, potentially.
I've reviewed most of these issues so far. Actually, I've reviewed all of them so far. And it's a really cool series. And it just looks like it's going to only get cooler.
Mm-hmm.
The Free Comic Book Day comic had some interior art shown. From the Venom portion, it's a traditionally they do two stories or maybe even three with a shorter one. But there's a Venom story and then there's a Spider-Man story. And in the Venom story, walk us through it, through us, Forrest.
Well, there's a you know, Donny Cates loves his cliffhangers, and it seems like the Venom story is going to end with the debut of a new character that was alluded to on Donny and Ryan Stegman's Twitters.
Yes.
Not too long ago. And I think also alluded to a little bit with the nuking of Venom Island recently. But there is a Venomized war machine painted in a kind of yellow motif, like Sleeper.
Yeah, it reminded me of
that
too.
Sleeper. But it's got like the Null symbol on its chest and stuff. And it seems like it has ill intentions towards my husband, Venom.
And he's also like a ramshackled suit. It's like made of like wires or
yes, it's like patched metal. Together. Yeah.
Yeah. And then meanwhile, in the Spider-Man one, Vulture, yeah. Black Cat and Spider-Man are fighting Vulture. It looks like a fun little fluffy story.
I was going to say a not interesting villain.
The art looks Vulture, fabulous.
Vulture has been a major player in Nick Spencer's story as well.
That's true. That is true. And that art is by Ryan Stegman in the Venom story and J.P. Meyer, I think. No, wait, sorry. Mm. Pat Gleason in the Spider-Man story.
Oh, Pat Gleason. Okay, cool.
Yeah. And then we also got to see some Mike Del Mondo art from the Threshing Place, the Immortal Hulk book he's doing with Jeff Lemire.
So good.
I think he's getting better and better, and it just makes me so angry. How can he get better?
Yeah.
And
astounding.
Then we got to see some Empire art. Looks like there's going to be some Gladiator games. Looks kind of interesting.
Yeah, Shi'ar, Kree, Skrull, that type of stuff, you know. Antiquated war that is very cool because men are beefy and have strange powers, and some of them are even blue.
Yeah, for sure. And green. Yeah. With butt chins.
Can you imagine?
There was also
I do think it looks very neat.
It does look really cool.
To be honest. And it does seem like they're really going to bat with like the entirety of the Marvel Universe is going to war. So I like seeing that they're all in on it, even though I don't really understand what it's about just yet.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think we find out in 2 weeks or no, a month and a half. We find out it starts, I think.
Okay.
I think, you know, I kept comparing it to War of the Realms because it's a war. But you were saying last night, you know, you dig cosmic stuff. And it made me realize, wait a minute. Yeah. War of the Realms it's obviously cosmic because obviously Thor is cosmic, but not so much. It's more of a fantasy, right?
It's fantasy. It's also very terrestrial. It's about the realms. It's specifically about Earth's place in them.
Where this is going to be more like, laser guns, spaceships.
Yeah. And I also think cosmic stuff inspires just the absolute weirdest from Marvel's writers and artists. So I'm excited about that.
Captain Marvel looks amazing with that hammer.
Mm-hmm.
I love that look. So if you check aftcomics.com, you can see all our coverage on C2E2, but we will be back next week to talk a little bit more, I'm sure. Also, Ari Bard from aftcomics.com is reporting. He did a fantastic job live tweeting the X-Men panel on Friday, and I'm excited to see what he writes up, because I'm sure he'll be doing some interviews and other stuff. But that's it for news this week. Next up, top books of last week, where we talk about our two favorite comics out last week. To start this segment, we always talk about comicbookroundup.com's top fan and critic pick. Does it sound like I'm getting better at this? I think I might be. I say it every week. The top critic pick was Invisible Kingdom number 10 from Dark Horse with a 9.4. And
yes.
The top fan pick, I'm going to just power through, John Constantine Hellblazer number 4 with a 9.7.
Major spoilers. Ingrid, about Invisible Kingdom, said, "Grixis and the crew of the Sundog are running out of places to hide," is the quote that Comic Book Roundup pulled. So nice. If that's interesting to you. And then a lot of really positive fan feedback on this John Constantine. I actually heard someone in the local comic store touting it the other day when I went in to pick up some books. Your Green Muse with a 9.5 says, "This was a great issue."
Hmm. Another short but sweet.
Yes.
Nathan Simmons loves it at AAPDComics.com. I think he gave it a 10, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe it was
that guy. Yeah.
He's pretty cool. Been on the show a couple times. I like his opinions. So, Forrest, what was your second favorite book of last week?
My second favorite book of last week is very difficult to talk about. I know I keep picking books that I don't want to spoil. It's a difficult proposition.
Sure is.
It's X-Men number 7. Written by Jonathan Hickman with art by Lino Francis Yu. I think that if you haven't been sold on Krakoa yet, or you haven't been sold on this kind of nation-building, religion-building, cultural-building aspect the X-Men is going for right now, which I'm personally all in on, this issue might cement it for you. I know some people have felt that the X-Men are being exclusionary, antagonistic, hostile, that they're bad guys, and that it's weird that the narrative is blind to that, although I don't necessarily see that myself. I think that this issue solves all of those problems with a very interesting, unique, and scary insight into exactly what's going on Krakoa. For better and worse.
A bit barbaric, if I don't want to spoil too much. Yeah. I reviewed this myself. I went into a little bit, basically what you just said. I just love how complex it feels. Like,
yes.
It yeah, gives you just enough to think about. And then pulls away.
I think it really works for me because I do feel that they're making a very concentrated effort to not betray a team or a really good Cyclops or whatever, which they can. But it doesn't feel like, oh, let's check in with the Avengers this week. It feels like, what are the goods and bads of a nation and of nation building?
Yeah.
It's much more complex than the X-Men have ever, maybe ever been.
Ooh, that could be a feature or segment for another time. The only thing that really pissed me off on that issue was Cyclops' visor. It was like odd. It had like an orb in the middle of it, and then it didn't. It was strange. Mm. It wasn't like a straight line.
Oh, well.
if you're, what are those people that need everything neat? Or if you're like that.
Particular, I don't know, yeah.
My second favorite book of the week was Far Sector, number 4, by N.K. Jemisin and Jamal Campbell. This is a book I think I've had on this list a couple times. It's about a character she's a Green Lantern, and in this issue, we find out she's not quite like any other Green Lantern. I'll leave it at that, so I don't spoil, too.
It's tough, right?
Yeah, I mean, I actually rushed to Ritesh after I finished reading it, because Ritesh has written quite a few really good in-depth Green Lantern pieces, and I was like, dude, you need to read this. It may or may not change what we know about the Green Lantern rings and how they work.
Mm.
So there's that, and then it's just the way the character's written. Jamal Campbell is amazing. I've loved Jamal Campbell's work for years now, and I keep wondering, like, when is he going to do, like, something really revolutionary? Because he's always doing, or at the time, he's always been a DC guy, but he's always been doing, like, Superman or Flash, and it looks fantastic, but because it's, like, your conventional Flash character running over water, it's like, okay, I've seen this. This is a book where he gets to really shine. There's so many hologram effects he's working with, because this is like a planet that way away from Earth, so far away that we've never seen it before. And there's all these alien races that he gets to draw. And yeah, it's just, it's really well done. And Jemisin's won a few Hugo Awards for her science fiction novels. I hope she just keeps writing comics and stops writing novels. Because I'm selfish and I want more comics from her. So yeah, that's my second favorite book. What is your number one book of the week?
Yeah, we can talk about our number one together. It is Grim Noir number 1, written by Jerry Duggan with art by Ron Garney. I love when creators have an idea that they obviously want to put out into the world, but they don't feel beholden to making it a big arc or story or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a simple idea about Ben Grimm investigating something that's wrong. In the apartment across the street from him, I guess you could put it simply. It's very noir in that way, like someone just getting involved in the overwhelming darkness of a crime because they're a good person.
Yeah.
I did feel that there was really no reason why the antagonist was hurting this person as well as Grimm, and I don't want to give it away, but the art, Ron Garney's art, just amazing. A lot of, like, existential dread and horror, and not in the style. I like Spider-Man Noir, but not in that style where it's like, oh, okay, now he's got a cigar, you know? It's actually, like, scary.
Yeah, I was thinking it was more like a horror book than a noir.
Yeah, yeah. But I think they threaded that needle well.
It's definitely very noir in the beginning. Like, it's, like, raining. He's in a trench coat. Mm-hmm. There are, like, detective characters.
Yeah, and then it gets borderline Lynchian.
Yeah, it gets twisted.
I really liked it. I saw that you tweeted a kind word to Jerry Dugan, so.
So Matt Miller, I think, should get some credit, too. His color on this book, the lighting in so many scenes, it just lifts up the already amazing work by Ron Garney. And, like, in an opening scene where there's, like, these demons and a nightmare of Ben's are, like, attacking him, and he's, like, falling. And it's just, like, it's almost, like, glowing the light off of them. It gives it, like, this angelic slash heaven kind of feel, even though they are demons trying to kill him. It's a very interesting probing into Ben Grimm, too. And he has the perfect personality for this story. I actually hope that Garney and Dugan and Miller get to go and do some more of these one-shots with other characters, and let's see what Captain America's nightmare looks like.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So that's it for Top Books of Last Week. In our next segment, Top Books for Next Week?
Question mark?
We are going to talk about the number one book we're anticipating out next week. My number one book. Tell me if you've ever heard this book before. It's Strange Adventures number one by Tom King, Mitch Gerads, and Doc Shaner. This book was announced at, I think, the last day of San Diego Comic-Con. I think it was a bit of a surprise that it came out. I was actually in the airport when I wrote some news about it. This is obviously the follow-up to Mr. Miracle. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of expectations on this, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And some of the imagery that's come out has suggested that this character, who's usually bright and shiny, and he's a science fiction character with a laser gun, may be dealing with some probably domestic issues. I'm here for the art more than anything. What I've seen from Gerads and Shaner is either clean or like gritty, and their two styles matched together, I think, could be really something really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they're going for an intentional like dichotomy, dualism in the story, and to see that, you know, in the art as well is always cool, I think.
And to be honest, you know, Mr. Miracle, I never really knew who he was, but I knew he was a superhero. And now we get to see this sci-fi adventurer go out and explore planets and fight aliens. So, mm-hmm. you know, I'm just guessing that's going to happen, but that's sort of his shtick. I'm like way more for that than I was for Mr. Miracle.
Cool.
What's
so this is strange, but in the neighborhood. My talk book for next week is Strange Academy number one, a Marvel production.
Wow.
Written by Scotty Young with art by Humberto Ramos. This is going to focus on the school that Doctor Strange is running for strange and magically gifted kids.
Yeah.
I love the idea of, you know, the X-Men Academy, Xavier's Academy. It's the perfect place to discuss growing up with powers, existential threats, as well as very real villain threats. And I just love all the crazy fourth wall breaking magic stuff. I think Scotty Young's a really fun writer who really understands like the heart of a child, or more accurately, the heart of a teenager. Middle West is all about that. I think it's going to be a great fit for these two, and I'm looking for a fun book.
Yeah, something lighter.
Yeah,
for the times. I think Ramos excels at teenage characters too.
Mm. Right. Yeah.
What did he do at Image Comics that was with the vampires? What was that?
Oh, I couldn't tell you. I know he did some great work on Spider-Man, but I couldn't tell you.
Crimson.
Mm.
I want to say that's how he broke in with Crimson. It was a while ago. Oh, it's actually Wildstorm. Huh. Forgot about that book. Okay, in our next segment, because, you know, we have a segment coming up with Zach Thompson and Emily Horn. Judging by the cover, Junior.
I'm going to record it someday.
I like to do it different every time.
Yeah.
What is your top cover of the week?
My top cover of the week is Harley Quinn number 71 with cover art by Guillaume Marsh. It says, "To Laugh and Die in L.A., guest starring Booster Gold." It's just a really fun, like, 60s propaganda-esque, pop art-esque poster. Harley's standing in the front. It actually reminds me quite a bit of, like, Riley Rossmo's art, too, which I can't compliment enough. Minimalistic color A lot of color, minimalistic detail, Harley standing front and center, looking down at the reader with a big gun and a big lollipop. It's not overly sexualized. It's not weird or anything. It's very in keeping with the vibe that they executed in Birds of Prey, which I loved. So I'm here for it.
Nice. You know, I was looking at it. I was looking for the cover to put into our feature image, mm-hmm. and I found it, but it was only in red. I guess there's like a pre-colored version that's kind of cool looking too.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I should check that out.
Yeah, you should check it out. You can actually see both of our picks at aaptcomics.com on this podcast post. My pick is Daredevil number 19 by Mike Del Mundo.
This is my other pick for the week. Sometimes one of us puts our cover in first, and I'm like, damn it.
I know, or yeah, that's happened to both of us on both sides. What I love about this cover, besides the fact that it's beautiful, he's got Daredevil's senses going with the circles around his head, and then that spins out into a web, and they're like cast out into the city sky. And then we have these beautiful buildings in the distance. They're both sort of floating through the air. He's really got the same kind of red tone on both characters, so they have this similar feel. He's also got some interesting shadow work going on both their faces, mm-hmm. to sort of convey the vigilanteism and whatnot. It's just really
Ooh.
Pretty. I just love the
Great
way
read.
The symmetry of like the webs and the circles. It's really cool. It really draws you in. It's like a bullseye in a sense.
Wow.
And that's it from me, folks. In our next segment, Zach Thompson and Emily Horn are going to come on to talk about their new Vault series, No One's Rose. Every rose has a thorn. And it's out March 25th. There are no thorns in this book. It's a sci-fi book, sort of a future dystopian title. We're going to get into it.
Yeah, we're going to get into it. I got questions. If you cut out all the spaces between our questions, I've written an essay about this book already. So let's get into it.
For real. So on the show, we have Zach Thompson and Emily Horn. Thank you so much for being on the show, guys.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
No One's Rose is out March 25th. Forrest and I have had the chance to read it. We're not going to spoil anything because this show is going up much earlier than March 25th. But we want to get into it a little bit if you guys feel comfortable doing that.
Let's definitely do it.
No One's Rose is a tense and exciting echo thriller with stakes that aren't usually explored in comics, I'd say. What outside media, like books or movies or games, inform the world and this story?
I think when Emily and I met about 3 years ago, she introduced me to Ursula Le Guin. And we talked a lot about her body of work and how a lot of her presence in sci-fi was inherently an act of rebellion. And that in that period, sci-fi was a very male-dominated space and was telling very sort of like male-centric stories. And if you look specifically at climate change, a lot of the forward-thinking theories tie a lot to feminism and a lot to identities that are not straight white males. And sort of by the idea of even tackling climate change and climate science in science fiction feels like an act of rebellion. It feels like you're breaking away from the things that are normally done. And we talked a lot about that. I mean, yeah, in 2017, we were both like, we have tons of climate anxiety. Like maybe we should do something about this. And, you know, that was it's only more prevalent now. Like we both are probably even more worried now than when we came up with the book, but yeah. It was very much sort of like looking at the world around us and seeing that no one was really talking about climate change in science fiction, in comics in particular. Mm-hmm. And there's some people in literature who are doing it right now. Like, you know, like Jeff Vandermeer does a really good job of dealing with the environment and climate change in a way that's very subtle and surreal.
And I think I actually, maybe you were tweeting about this book because you were writing No One's Rose, but I ended up reading some of Timothy Morton's Humankind Solidarity with Non-Human People.
Yeah.
And I can see some of that in this as well.
That is a large part of what kind of, as the series develops, I can't get into it too much because it's spoiler
of course,
territory, but there's some of that in there. And I think like we watched a lot of TNG. Because TNG, like, and I think you were talking about how it, like, it's a very, like, anthropological look at stuff, right?
Yeah, So I think that one of the things we were talking about was how there's no kind of positive visions of the future. And No One's Rose is not in and of itself a positive vision of the future. It's definitely post-catastrophic climate change. And it's kind of a call to action, I think. But one of the things that we started talking about was there's not a lot of utopian fiction out there, or kind of fiction that you can look forward to. We sort of started writing it around when Black Mirror was really big. And I think I just kept being like, well, what are the kids today reading to kind of like look forward to the future? And what are people, you know, what is anyone consuming in popular media that is like, hey guys, the future will be like good enough to live in? It seems like everything is about how it's going to be like surveillance states and terrible in all respects. So to go back to what Zach was saying about Star Trek The Next Generation, I really love that show because it somehow successfully creates a lot of like conflict and a lot of like interesting tension between different species and like different sort of like planets. And at the same time, at the heart of it, you just have a crew of people who are really good natured, who really love each other, and they love these different species, and they just want to connect with them. So I think that that was an interesting challenge. And I think that we kind of, No One's Rose issue one is sort of like in media res, it's kind of in the middle of what we had originally written as a novel. So we kind of have this like long lead up to it in what used to be a novel where it's like, hey, this society is really amazing. But what we're seeing in No One's Rose number one is kind of the decline of this once really great society. So I think
Emily, spoilers.
Oh,
I'm just teasing. We should back up for a second and say the book itself. Let's intro the book as a concept for people who are not aware of it.
Sure.
So No One's Rose takes place inside the Green Zone, which is sort of like the last bastion of humanity, a domed city that sort of keeps the natural environment in check and is slowly sort of working to increase its borders and keep spreading and repopulating the planet and taking like carbon out of the air and making, you know, the planet livable again, and very much incremental steps. And it's been in place for a couple centuries at this point. And as you'll see in issue one, some societal grouping has happened. Some class systems have emerged over time that weren't exactly there to begin with. And we're sort of seeing this place after several hundred years of success. There's some cracks starting to form, and we follow two teen characters, a brother and sister named Ten and Saren. Ten works within the system of the government to sort of affect change, and her brother finds a different group that he aligns with, for lack of a better way to describe it. But it is sort of like presenting this thing. A lot of people who are reading it are sort of seeing there's some elements of it that are stuck in time. Uh-huh. And that's very much what the book is sort of exploring, is like, this is a utopian sort of vision of the future, but a very specific type of utopian vision that's sort of stuck in some of our conventional ways of seeing our current society. Mm-hmm. And sort of not really stepping outside of a separation between the self and the environment, and more so thinking about the environment as something that can be closed off and kept finite and sort of protected, where in reality, you know, there's a lot more growth that needs to be had, and there's a lot more forward action that has to be taken. And we see some of that in the first issue, but we're going to really unpack it as the series goes forward.
You've both mentioned TNG. Have you guys watched the new Picard show at all?
Yes.
Does it bum you out like it bums me out?
it it has its moments, but it's also just like, it's so filled with so many like winks and nods. And I'm just like, I don't need them to say Earl Grey tea 6 times an episode before. I'm like,
hey, we watched the show too.
Yeah, exactly.
I asked because a lot of what you're saying reminds me of this Picard show. Not that it's your comic similar at all. It's just that it's sort of gone in this new direction where the Federation was always like this beacon of hope, and it's become kind of trashy and not as good as we thought it was. And that's a bummer to me.
I don't like that either. Cause I think it sort of is thematically flying in the face of what Starfleet was always supposed to be.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it comes back to that. Like, Star Trek existed in this like amazing time when people in the 90s were ready to watch a show that was like deeply philosophical, but that had this like really operatic setting, this like space opera setting. So even though there wasn't, people got zapped and stuff, but
people got zapped.
They got zapped. Tasers.
It's just crazy. Like Uhura like meets Lincoln, I think, in one episode, and she doesn't even know what racism is because it's been dead for so long. And then Picard seems to suggest there's racism again. I don't know. It's strange.
Yeah, that's, I think, a lot of what No One's Rose is reacting to is the like the idea of like a gritty reboot, right? Like that's what Picard feels like at some times. It's like, well, how do we make this shit dirtier? And you're I like Starfleet being like really clean and like altruistic and nice, right? Like, you know, the whole draw of it is like, maybe you want to join and sort of like, you know, lead that mission to discover new worlds and be kind to others and sort of like, I don't know, I could go on a long rant about this, but yeah.
I think the inspiration behind 10 really like aligning with the governing party in the dome it's very altruistic, right? Like she really wants to build a better world and she thinks that's the best way to do it, which feels like a very TNG kind of thing.
We very much wanted one of the characters to be working within the system to try and affect change. A lot of what you see in science fiction, especially with young teenage protagonists, is like, I'm going to lead a rebellion to like change the way that things are done. But, you know, you look around the world and you go like, well, we still need people to be politicians. Yes, American politics is a clusterfuck right now, but you still need people to want to work within the system to affect change. And we're going to need people who got into it for the right reasons, who are altruistic in their motives, to try and change the way that climate change is sort of affecting us now. We need people who work within the governing parties to actually do something about it, right?
Right, right. Or nothing will get done.
Yeah, and it sucks. Like, I would love to blow it all up and just sort of, rebuild, but that's not going to happen.
No. Yeah, that makes sense. It's a complex world.
So to pivot just a little bit, and with the imagery of this utopian agrarian society in mind, in a bubble in particular, can you tell us a little bit about developing the visual language of No One's Rose? I was really struck by the unique high fantasy futurism of it. Like, people have headbands and capes and stuff like that again.
Yeah, I mean, that is a lot to Alberto's credit. We worked really closely with him in terms of developing a visual language for the buildings and all of the clothing and stuff. And he was sort of involved really early on in this process, because Vault has sort of like a longer development process than is typical in creator-owned publishers. Was it the end of 2018, Emily, that the things became sort of like official and the book was like good to go?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. And Alberto probably came on not too long after. I think like early 2019, he started developing this world with us. And that gave us a really long time to go like, okay, what does transportation look like? What do clothes look like? Where do they bury their dead? What, you know, what does the governing party do? What are the people who are in like waste management do? How do we purify water? Where are we getting our water? Where are we geographically? And Alberto was just like so down to get into the weeds with us about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, go ahead.
I was just going to say that Alberto brought so much style to it. So I really feel like the face tattoos and the actual clothing that they're wearing, he came up with that all on his own. So that's something he brought. And he made them like insanely stylish, which I really like. But I think in terms of the technology, that's definitely something that Zach and I talked over so much. And we, for years, have been sending each other articles, like literally years, sending each other articles about sustainable technology and what that would look like. And thinking about, like Zach was saying, how water would be distributed through a world like this, how waste would be produced. And we had this funny moment where we're just like, what if people die? Where do they go? Like, do they just toss them outside the dome? So in a later series, you'll actually see some of the nitty gritty of how the waste is processed. And it's been a really fun process, actually.
Cool. Yeah.
That's funny. One of our questions is, what research did you do to inform the book, and how did you decide what to put in and what to leave out?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, that's a very, like, we have a gigantic Bible for this world, as you can probably imagine.
Yeah. It feels very realized from page one, I would say.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, like, again, like, because we were building it as a novel, we sort of like knew, like, we had written this huge backstory and how this world had come to be. And we had like a, like a 200-year timeline, I think, that sort of like outlined what happened every 5 years for 200 years from, and like, it was crazy. And, but it was really helpful once it became time to like start executing things, because it was like this really nice look at the, like this topographical look at this giant world we've built, and going, okay, all right, this is cool, but now that we have a story, we have to make sure that all of this stuff that like characters would know living in this world, mm-hmm. no one's going like, as you know, we get rid of our waste this way. Like, that's just terrible, right? Yeah. And so a lot of it was like, okay, cool. Well, how do we take this closed system, this thing that is sort of like inherently sustainable, all parts of it, all parts of the society, all the people who play roles within it, how do we pick people who are at two very interesting points in that system and show their ideological differences, but also sort of have them be informed enough that when they're walking through this world, you're learning about how it works without ever having to like step outside of a character's perspective and be like hit with exposition.
Right. And right.
That's yeah. really that's a drag. But it's been nice to see this, because like, I think when we sort of released the book to some other pros and stuff and got people to read it at first, we were like deathly afraid that people are going to be like, this is the biggest like snore fest in the world. And it was mostly just because you don't know if you're communicating something organically in an interesting way, or if it feels like you're hitting people over the head because you've been so in the world for so long that you're like, I don't know anymore. I live in this world with these people. So I'm unclear as to whether or not. But yeah, so it came back down to always grounding it through a character's perspective, doing world building only in perspective. And if you do that, the characters sort of will react to things in a way that feels natural. Hmm. And then skillful readers, I believe, will be able to intuit and connect the dots on their own without us having to spell out literally everything.
That's a relief, right? Because so often you might see something in a comic or movie and it's like, that's just there to look cool. That has no meaning to anything, you know?
Yeah, we've had some moments where it's like, I'm particularly obsessed with making sure everything makes sense within the world, probably to a point that's like too much. But for me, it's really important that the world feels authentic, and that people can see themselves in this world. And I think that that's something that, you know, like I personally have longed for, is like cool, like, we've seen the ways that the world doesn't work. Like, let's look at the ways the world could work. And there's just so much inspiration out there. Honestly, like, it's just been so... I feel more optimistic now having, like, written this, because we did so much research on all these great technologies that are coming out all the time. And my Twitter feed is, like, super boring because I just tweet about, like, sustainable technologies, which no one knows how to connect with. But for me, it's just, like, a running tally of kind of, like, optimism. Like, it keeps me optimistic.
Mm-hmm. So I was going to – you alluded to it a little bit, especially with talking about sharing technological advances, real-world ones with each other. There's a lot of real-world science in the first issue of No One's Rose, ecological, biological, technological. How did you thread the needle between putting real science into the book and not making it daunting or boring for readers?
Oh, boy. Yeah. I mean, like, that's the constant struggle, I think, with some
things.
And I think that, like, luckily we have Adrian Wassel, who's the editor on the book, and he's been such a champion of, like, just, I don't know, like, there was this version of this first issue that existed where way early on in the process, it had, like, no science in it. And it was, like, sort of just, like, look at the world, it's fun. And then, like, Adrian was like, where's the science, guys? Like, I know you guys have done the research. Like, why didn't you put it in? And we were just like, we're just so deathly afraid of, like, you know, making people bored out of their minds. But we started talking about, you know, the things that got us inspired were doing this research and learning about these processes. And it's like, it's not very often you get to put those processes into a story, right? And so, again, making sure that it is through the lens of a character where you experience these things, you hopefully empathize with it more because the characters care about it. And we tried to make it specifically part of their struggle or their journey, is that, like, one of the characters is a scientist and she is doing science and you see her do it and she explains it, but she's also explaining it because, you know, we're trying to teach you something. So as the series progresses, you can see the writing on the wall because you now know the science for what's coming.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that we tried to be pretty careful about the introduction of the science. Like, we try to keep it. The interesting thing about climate change is now a lot of people know what carbon dioxide is, and they understand how that contributes as a greenhouse gas. And they also might understand how carbon is, like, an organic building block or something, right? Like, I think
I think that you're right. I think that the reception to this book or the reading of this book would be different even in, like, 2010.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. We talk about methane, and that's something that we talk about a lot in the news. Like, the general level of engagement with science is a lot higher today. So I think it was finding the appropriate level to kind of introduce to people. So we have 10 talking about carbon as a organic building block, because we kind of want to set it up so nobody feels like they're being left out. And that we try to explain it a little bit to kind of move forward. And I think that might be, like, kind of ramping it up. I think that's what we're trying to do with it.
You know, hearing you guys talk about world building, it makes me think, do you play D&D? And if so, you would probably be amazing dungeon masters, if not.
So I do, but I don't know. Em, do you?
I played Star Wars D&D.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. But yeah, that was like 5 years ago.
Still counts.
Still counts.
Is there any interest to, like, take No One's Rose and, like, do a D&D campaign with the world?
Oh, dude. Yeah, that sounds delightful. Honestly. Like, yeah. I used to do D&D with Curtis Weeb, who wrote Rat Queens for years.
Yeah.
And he was our DM for our group. And that's actually, like, sort of how Lonnie and I got to be really close friends is like we were in the same D&D group and sort of able to riff with one another. And we sort of saw how easily our characters could get like lost on a thread of insanity together. And then it was like, maybe we should write, like, this is crazy. But it sort of, yeah, I thought about that a lot as like kind of making a homebrew solarpunk RPG set within this world. And like, there's so much that's coming, in the series that sort of would like add interesting wrinkles to said game that I can't get into, but would gladly tell you guys about it after we're done recording.
Hit sure. me up. Yep. Sure. Play D&D like 3 times a week. Let's talk.
Like, ever since I found out the Expanse was originated from a D&D like homebrew thing, and then it just blew up from there, I just always think like, God, this is like the best way to create something that could become like an entire, like, you know, industry.
Well, do you want to know the truth is that when we are originally building out this world, we used a lot of D&D mechanics to...
Oh, interesting.
Like both Ten and Saren, we rolled those characters.
Oh, cool.
And we did that because it instantly gives your character like a moral compass. You start to know their skills. And then like, I think that like, if that's one of my secret tricks as a writer, it's like, I do that pretty frequently because I like sort of just, you know, it might change from how you roll them at the beginning, but at least it gives you sort of a set, sort of idea of how to run with this character. And then as you write them, they'll start to develop on their own. But it really helps, I think, for me. And you get a good motivation out of it too, in a really real way.
Right. They become more real with, like, you know, they're not like perfect or Superman or whatever.
Yeah. You really have to build in those flaws or else.
Right. Exactly. The flaws. Yeah.
So this one might get into a little bit of spoiler territory. And if you have to be mum's the word, that's okay. But it seems from marketing as well as reading the first issue that No One's Rose is going to take a unique look at the relationship between humans and non-humans and their respective rights. Can you tell us a little bit about evoking empathy for non-human characters?
Yeah, I mean, that is, without getting too deep into it, that is sort of what issue 2 is all about. And then sort of like... the philosophical question that is sort of at the underpinning of the book, how best to answer this?
Sorry.
No, it's, I think, good. Yeah, go ahead, Em.
Yeah, so Timothy Morton is definitely a strong influence, I think, on the book. And that's really to Zach's credit, because he... was like, we've got to incorporate all this philosophy. And I was like, yes, like, we definitely do. I think the book explores different environmentalisms. And I think that that's pretty forward thinking. I think when we think about environmental like strategies, it's just sort of like, I'm an environmentalist or I'm not an environmentalist. And I think what we're finding now is that it's a little more nuanced than that. So you have environmentalists who eat meat and they eat dairy, but they sort of like turn a blind eye to the contributions of cattle to climate change, for instance. So I think that's explored a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, it obviously came from a place of like, when you look at a lot of environmentalist theory, there's some things that are perpetuated that sort of run concurrently with capitalism that are not exactly sustainable, right? Like in the best way possible, living in harmony with nature is a lot more complicated than inventing your way out of climate change. It comes down to having empathy for things that, you know, we don't perceive to be as conscious, I guess. And, you know, there's not a lot of thought about regenerative efforts that sort of prioritize, you know, like we cut down trees to put up solar panels. That's fucked up. That doesn't make any sense, right? And like, and that's the sort of like what we're trying to explore with the book without getting too deep into it, is the idea of like, how do you reconcile something like that? How do you explain that you're an environmentalist and you're trying to be sustainable, but you're cutting down a forest to put up swaths of solar panels? Those, like, instead, you should definitely be building solar panels, but you should be doing it in a space where you don't also have to cut down trees, which are, you know, one of our best ways of forgoing a lot of the damage that we're doing to our environment currently. And it's taking a more holistic approach to like biodiversity and just, and thinking about the ways that you can sort of poke holes in conventional environmentalist thought and accommodate a different type of thinking. And, you know, as you have hinted, the people who hold the other side are not exactly, they don't have it all figured out either. You know?
Okay. Yeah.
And it's a lot about exploring differing environmentalist ideologies, I guess is the best way to say it without getting too deep into the weeds about spoilers and stuff.
But it's super fun.
Well, that's a perfect segue into our next question. How do you approach writing about scary and divisive topics like climate emergency and ecoterrorism without making it scary and exhausting for the reader?
Yeah, obviously that's a line that we're treading pretty carefully. I think I'm personally exhausted with sort of like climate news and climate change. And so I think that honestly for me, it's, and I think Zach as well, it's like, how do you create a really engaging narrative between two protagonists that can carry you all the way through the story, but also tie in some environmental themes with that. So it's kind of like the sugar to go down with the medicine, I guess. It's like, I think it would be great if people walked away from this book thinking differently about, you know, the way that they approach the environment. It would be great if people discovered some new environmental technologies, but it would be equally successful if they walked away and they were like, that was a really great story about a brother and a sister who had differences that they, you know, may or may not reconcile. And for me, it's successful any of those routes. I kind of just hope that there's more science fiction that includes environmentalism in it, because honestly, that's just the world that we're living in now. So I think if you can create it in an engaging way, in a fun way, that people don't immediately go like, ugh, like it's climate fiction, then I think that's successful. Because to go back to my previous point, like, I would love for some kid, or I keep going back to kids, it's a book for everyone, but I just keep thinking about like, how are we inspiring kids? Like, how are we encouraging them to explore environmentalism and to explore this like new world that we're moving into, and not make it scary? So it's really important to us, I think, that it's fun.
I was driving home from work last night. NPR had a story about this UK coal plant that's closing like 3 years early because it's burning wood pellets. And they were like talking about how great it is for the environment. But then they were like, but we have to cut down American, because they're getting American lumber, trees to make these pellets. So isn't it just it's not really a zero emissions anymore. It's still an emissions in some way because those trees are being taken away from the earth, right? So then I was like bummed out by the end of the story.
Yeah, and that's the like part of the reason that we made the book about teen protagonists was to sort of go like, okay, well, there's this era of everyone's life where they're, you know, a young teenager and they're sort of discovering things about themselves for the first time. And, you know, it's also no secret that like probably the number one group of people who are experiencing climate anxiety right now
right.
are teens. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, how do you tell a story about two teens who see the world changing and are scared about that, but go about solving these problems completely differently? And can they sort of like reconcile their differences with one another to sort of help each other gain the future that they're looking for? Or are they too far gone that they'll never listen to one another? And, you know, it's a lot about exploring that political divide just as much as it is about coming to terms with these giant problems, but making sure that the characters that we're experiencing it through are like fun and interesting and feel well-developed. Because, you know, it's so easy to get lost in the boring and scary details of climate change to a point where you're just like, you feel sick to your stomach. And we want people to feel activated, and we want people to get like, you know, read it and feel like, fuck, like that's awesome. Like, I feel like I've seen something in the world that I want to see more of, or fuck, I got to go learn more about climate change so I can talk to my friends about this. But we don't want them to walk away and be like, we're doomed, right? And I think right. that's the narrative that just keeps getting perpetuated that is, like, you know, problematic. It's important to have things that, like, you know, I don't think No One's Rose is the perfect solution that is going to solve climate change. But I hope that people read it and they think about climate change. That's it, you know, and have that sort of, like, reflection on it where they're like, maybe I should act in this small way that's different, right? Like, I don't know. I like writing the book has turned me into basically a vegan, and it's a really simple way to like lower your impact. And, you know, it also has helped my digestion.
But right, also right. secretly so much vegan junk food.
Yeah.
I bet.
Yeah. There's a lot. And
it's great.
Delicious. Emily, this is your first comics work, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Can you tell us about the differences you've found between this project and other writing or creative works you've done?
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of the work that I've done before, so I've secretly written a lot of short fiction, and I've written a lot of articles for different like art zines and stuff like that. And it's just sort of like scattershot over the last 10 years. So a lot of it is short form.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely, and we started this out as a novel. We were co-writing it as a novel. I'm way more comfortable in prose form. Mm-hmm. And then sort of like scripting presented this like new challenge. I'd also done scripting for different projects, but this was sort of the first time I was doing it in comic format. So it was interesting. I have a lot of respect for comic book writers, comic book artists, and colorists and letterers, because it's really this like you need to come together and kind of like this sort of, it's kind of like jazz, I guess, right? Because you create the script and you're like, okay, the script is down. We've described the scenes and this is the way it's going to look. And then your artist brings so much to it, right? And Alberto is so amazing. So he adds his own world building, right? And the characters in the scenes look a little different than you would expect. And so you end up going back and then you'll go back in and change the text so that if they look angry, they're saying something angry. If they look, you know, calmer than you expected, you change the language around that. So... And then the colorist brings another dimension, right? Where it's like, it sets the tone for different scenes and the world. And so you're kind of, it's kind of this iterative process that I really, really like. So from day one to like the final day when it's getting sent out, like you're kind of making changes. And I like that. I like that a lot. Especially because I'm like someone who like before I send an email, I read it like 10 times. So it's nice to have like so many opportunities to kind of revise, go back, revise. It's a really fun process.
Nice. Zach,
thanks.
How would you describe the differences in your writing and creative process for a creator-owned book with Vault versus one, say, for Marvel?
I mean, I could be here all day and and get into the weeds about it. I think it's a lot of, like, you know, with something like this in particular, it's climate change is a difficult subject to tackle, and you know, I've pitched a variety of different, like, eco-centric projects and have pretty much fallen on, like, deaf ears. Just people don't actually really want to touch it. But Vault was the exception. And so when you come to a publisher with a project like that that is inherently going to be a little bit trickier than is typical, you sort of expect them to either go one of two directions where they're like, I'm going to turn a blind eye and you just do whatever the hell you want and we'll figure it out. But Adrian was really instrumental in creating this book because he championed it in a really unique way. And, like, right from the get-go was like, I know exactly what you guys are trying to do. He was like a wealth of knowledge and recommended so many fantastic books and sort of, like, was really interested in elevating what we were already setting out to do. And I think, Marvel sometimes is a lot about what their goals are and how do you sort of as a writer align with the goals of the publisher. And I find with creator owned a lot of the time the publisher goes, how do we align with your goals as a creative person? What are you trying to say? What are the themes you're trying to tackle? And how can we help you do that in the best way possible?
It sounds like a marriage.
Yeah, and it works. You know, it's really like
God, and Marvel is Tinder, I think.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it feels that way, and like there's nothing wrong with the Marvel method, because here's the thing, right?
Yeah,
you can very easily get lost in the weeds when you're doing creator-owned to the point where it's like you're just world building forever, and then your story doesn't actually make any sense to anyone. And you're just like, you've gone completely off the rails. And with Marvel, you have these very finite rules. You know exactly what you can do and what you can't do. And sort of, you have a huge pool of information and shit that you can just pull. Right. Oh, we're doing a book in space. Okay, well, we know the Kree and the Skrull exist in space. Why don't we put a Kree guy here that's going to solve this problem in this way? Whereas, like, you know, if you're doing something in your own world and you're like, hey, we need someone to come in and represent this thing, you either have to create it from the ground up, or right. You have to think about why a certain thing would be there at that time. And it requires, you know, 10 extra steps. That's not actually, you know, a problem in Marvel, because there's oftentimes you can just Wikipedia, like, has this thing happened or is this character alive? And it's like, okay, he's alive. Cool. He's here now. You know?
Nice.
And
yeah.
Get here. He took a speed of light ride. Now he's here. Yeah. But it, you know, it's like, it's working in a world with very finite rules. And then it's working in a world where you make your own rules. And I think that, like, you can do big sprawling creator owned if you have good discipline to sort of make sure that you're getting into the weeds about how to make your world work. But I think, without, like, singling anything out, I've read a lot of science fiction comics that sort of feel like they're lost in their own world and not necessarily super concerned about me as a reader and welcoming me in. And, like, that's, you know, there's certain levels to which people enjoy their entertainment. Some people like being thrown in and sort of, like, learning how to swim in the deep end and then kind of figuring your way out around the world. But I think that, like, when it comes to communicating big worlds, if you do your proper sort of world building methods, you can make sure that it's still accessible to people and they still feel like they're not super overwhelmed. And that's always the goal, is making sure that, like, things still move effortlessly, but you are engaged and you're like, you have questions about the world, but they're not questions that impede your ability to enjoy it, but rather elevate the sense of discovery that pushes you forward in the story.
I know we've been talking about science fiction for 40 or so minutes now, but when it comes to genres, is there one you feel most comfortable writing in?
I'm probably horror. That's my favorite. And oftentimes, like when I'm sort of working on something like this, and then I'm like, I hit a roadblock, I'll just go and start writing some other horror book or some idea that I shouldn't be writing that I'm putting time into, because it's sort of like, that's my escape place. But like, the other thing that I'm super conscious of is like, one, being collaborative is really important to me. Like, one of the reasons that I really wanted to do this project was because like, this idea was Emily's, she brought it to me and was like, here's what I'm thinking of. And I was like, you know, I'm in a position now where I can come in and be like, you already know I work with co-writers. Right. Let's do this book with a new co-writer. And Vault's super happy to have Emily on board. And it makes me sort of like step outside of what would traditionally be my comfort zone and be challenged in new ways as a writer. So I'm always sort of like pushing in a new direction. I really resist the impulse of getting like nailed down to doing only one thing and doing it well. I really just want to be able to like be a chameleon and fall into all kinds of different genres. Mm-hmm. And that, because that to me keeps it interesting for readers and also keeps it interesting for me. I'm never, you know, like I'm working on three books right now. One's a crazy Western, one a climate fiction set in you know, centuries in the future, and then another is like a sexy horror, body horror book. And like none of them occupy even like slightly similar space, but that allows me to keep them very separate from one another. Right. The ideas don't blend into one another. And I think that when you do too much work in one genre, you can sort of start sounding like yourself too much. Mm. And you're not really actually pushing your themes forward. And so that's like, if I have a certain genre that I'm writing, I don't pitch that genre until that project is over.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Emily, is there a genre you prefer writing in?
I actually really like meditative sort of explorations of people, your sort of like internal, like exploring a really emotional stories. I think that's a lot of what I've written historically, as well as sci-fi. So it's kind of like on either side of the spectrum. It's either like super navel-gazy or just like very sci-fi. Those are the two that I sort of feel the most comfortable writing in.
Nice.
Okay, so Emily, this next question is a callback to previous interviews with Zach and Lonnie, but I would love if you would weigh in too. How would Yondu fare in the world of No One's Rose?
How would Yondu fare?
Yes.
I feel like he would, because he's so like gritty and kind of dirty.
Piece of shit.
I feel like he would be like immediately relegated to the gray zone. Yeah. Like he'd be polluting. Like, he'd be polluting in the gray zone, and they'd be like, "You can't live here. I'm sorry."
Is he standing outside the zone with like 1,000 cigars? What's he doing?
Exactly. Yeah, he's just running a generator that's not attached to anything.
That's funny. Well, that ends our interview portion. In our next segment, Off Topic Chop Shelf, we're going to ask you guys, what are you into right now that's not comics related? What is something that you're fancying?
Yeah. Em, do you want to go first or do you want me to take it?
As in like something that I'm reading or something.
And anything that's not reading. Comics. Yep.
Yeah. What you could be into a whiskey right now.
I'm reading Uncanny Valley right now. Have you guys heard of that book? It's about one woman's experience in Silicon Valley.
No, but it sounds cool.
No, yeah.
It is very funny. You guys probably watch Silicon Valley.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
On HBO. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I'm finding a lot of joy in reading this book because it's basically just like this scathing takedown of tech culture. Mm. Kind of the, I don't know, like the everyone wearing a Patagonia vest and just like all these decadent things that tech bros do without even realizing. So I'm reading that and I'm really enjoying that. And then I actually just came today from doing a big presentation pitch for a podcast within my master's program. So my world has kind of just recently, or just, yeah, like recently has just been doing my master's, writing No One's Rose, doing my master's. So that's kind of like where my head has been. That's a jumble of things that I'm currently I'm currently involved in.
Zach, what are you into right now? I know we asked you this question like 2 weeks ago.
Well, that's changed though.
Oh, good.
Ever evolving. I'm reading J.G. Ballard's Crash right now. Rereading, I guess I should say, and sort of reading a lot of his short fiction. Lonnie and I have just started working on a new book, and sort of inspired by a little bit of Ballard. So I'm kind of getting into the weeds on the research phase of a new book, but particularly just sort of, there's a book of short stories called Vermilion Sands that he wrote that takes place at like a futuristic resort that is actually very utopic in quality. And each short story explores a different form of like artistic expression. And I just love Ballard in general. He was like, he had such a scathing critique of, you know, 20th century society. And, you know, he's like, his prose is like lurid and gross and dripping and wet, but still like so accurate. And like, I don't know. I love that idea. Like Crash is so interesting to me because he describes it as a book, like the first like sexual book about technology.
Huh.
And like that really, you know, like activates me as a person just because I love that kind of thing about like that intersection of how people see themselves interacting with machines is even more prevalent now, and sort of like exploring Crash through the lens of like 2020 is very different than like when it was written in, I think, like 71. So to think back about writing a book like that, that's like described in the 70s about a book about being sexual and technology, I'm like, holy shit, that was 50 years early. He's brilliant.
Yeah.
So
I think both High Rise and Atrocity Exhibition read that way too.
Yeah.
I haven't read Crash. I should check that out.
It's phenomenal. Yeah. It's really good. And it's pretty short. It's about 160 pages.
Oh, so cool.
It's a quick read.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, guys. No One's Rose is coming out March 25th from Vault Comics. Check that out. Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having us.